Right. For our reflection this morning, I would like to quote from Alice Anichikia Naisman, who wrote, "In a world so filled with brokenness and sorrow, it would be easy to lose ourselves in never-ending grief, to be choked by our outrage, to be paralyzed by the enormity of suffering, to feel our hearts squeeze tight with hopelessness. Instead, this morning, let us simply breathe together as we hold our hearts open. Breathe in as our hearts fill with compassion. Breathing out as we pray for healing in our world and in our lives. Breathing in, opening ourselves to the transforming power of love. Breathing out as we pray for peace in our world and in our lives. Breathing in as we hold hope in our hearts. Breathing out as we pray for justice in our world and in our lives. May we know our strength. May we be filled with courage. May our love flow from us into this world.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for giving me the chance to talk with you all this morning. Since what I've been asked to do today, to deliver, is a homily, and homilies aren't so much dialogues as speeches, I'm more used to the kind of dialogue conversation, I thought I'd start with just going ahead and giving all of you a chance to speak truth to power regarding my talk before I even begin it. So if some of you have pens and papers handy, or if you don't, you can just do this in your head. I'd like you to take out your pen and paper now and write the following. Dear Chet, your ideas are all wrong, and your sermon provides ample proof that you are a fool. I don't see anyone writing, but thank you for your faith. Seriously, though, I'd like you to imagine, or ask you to imagine, that after my talk, you really don't agree with a lot of what I say. And you don't especially care for the worldview I speak from. But you're not sure that the neighbor in the pew or the chair in front of you or behind you agrees. So I'd like you to take a minute and just turn to someone ahead of you, behind you, someone who's not your family member or close friend, and try to express, you know, start a conversation and that you're going to get to saying, you know, I don't know what he's doing here. I don't really agree with his approach. Could you just take a moment and do that? Just introduce yourself and start that conversation? All right. Did it feel a little uncomfortable to kind of talk that way, you know, just so soon? And if so, I'm glad. You Unitarians are a pretty independent lot. I'm guessing it also didn't feel right being told just what to write down. I didn't notice any of you did it. Or what to think. I hope that's true. I'm also guessing when you turned to your neighbor that very few of you used a word like fool in expressing your disagreement to your neighbor. Most of you were probably a lot more Canadian and diplomatic and polite. Some of you may not even have gotten to the disagreement part before you ran out of time. Now, ask yourselves how your responses would have been different if you were just commenting anonymously online, or on a column maybe that I'd written, where you just comment below. Now, I'm not saying anyone here is an internet troll. I am saying, though, that millions of times every day, via email and social media, via tweets and online comments under someone's published column, insults and dismissals, the equal of calling me a fool, and much worse, get posted. Hurtful, unfair things, often said in the knowledge that there is little chance that the insulter and the one insulted will ever meet. How many of you have ever sent an email you regretted? I know I have. So what's the difference between how we express our views to a neighbor in person and how we might comment online to someone we don't know, or maybe even someone we do? The difference, if you ask me, and you kind of did in asking me to talk here, is relationship. You attend church with the people in the chairs around you. You're going to see, talk with, maybe work with them all again. At some level, you probably also understand that you and the other people in this room hold certain values in common. Despite your disagreement over one sermon from this guy who asked you to turn and comment before you'd even heard it, you are still participating in a common story. And that story is still being told by both of you. Now, you might say, but what about how we often take our frustrations out on and say things we don't mean to those we love most? Anyone ever done that? I mean, thankfully, I never have. And just a note to my family, you're not allowed to talk now. Seriously, though. The key issue here is relationship again. Our closest companions are exactly those we trust to forgive us our trespasses. They have more context. They know something closer to the whole story of us. They know and could assure others that we're not always like that. So there's a space between the anonymity of great distance, with people we don't see as part of our common story, and those we trust most to see our worst selves. And what I'm saying is that democracy and civil society itself depends on the dialogues we have in that middle space. The people we don't know so well, in the pew or the chairs in front of or behind us, those in the church or synagogue, mosque or club meeting across the street, the colleagues at work we don't so often socialize with. What stories do we see ourselves participating in with them? What common values might we hold? So here's part of my story. For 5 years, starting when I was in my early 20s, I lived in a tiny rural community called Cascabel, Spanish vernacular for rattlesnake, in the Sonoran Desert of southern Arizona, less than an hour's drive from the U.S.-Mexico border. About 200 residents lived scattered among the saguaro forest hills and washes along several linear miles of the San Pedro River, the last undammed, free-flowing river in the American Southwest. I'd gone there as a kind of apostate, an alienated young man fleeing a culture I found brutal to the people and values I held. Growing up in small town East Texas, I'd seen my mother nearly bankrupt herself more than once, trying to care for a younger sister who'd been the victim of terrible violence and needed help recovering from trauma in a place and culture where no such help existed. I went to Cascabel, as I've come to Victoria, seeking real human community, a place and culture where people do a better job of caring for each other. In Cascabel, I had the chance to learn from and work with Jim Corbett, co-founder and strategic mastermind of the Sanctuary Movement, the movement that created a new underground railroad of safe houses and churches, sanctuaries, for Salvadoran and Guatemalan refugees fleeing across the U.S.-Mexico border to escape political persecution. Jim was a brilliant iconoclast, a cowboy who spent long hours herding goats and cattle out on wild desert range, yet who refused all the trappings of stereotypical cowboy culture, preferring black Teva sandals and a floppy white canvas hat to a Stetson and boots. Not caring what more traditional ranchers around him thought, he did most of his herding on foot and earned the animals' trust instead of scaring them into compliance. He'd grown up on a hardscrabble cattle ranch in Wyoming before getting a Harvard philosophy degree. He could both lay out the legal and moral case for the defiance of U.S. immigration policy and personally lead groups of refugees across the border through miles of remote and rugged desert, feeding them on goat's milk from two does he milked along the way. I remember first watching Jim approach cows on range back when I, who had not grown up in ranching, still felt cautious about how to relate to such large and powerful creatures. He would speak softly when he got within hearing distance. He made a soft, guttural sound in greeting, approaching from the side, not head-on, because cows' eyes are on the sides of their heads, and they regard head-on approach as a sign of challenge. Jim would approach from the side and raise his hand to the cow's muzzle when he reached her, letting her take in his scent and recognize him. Often the cows stretched out their necks so he could scratch the dewlap, the sensitive skin below their necks. He moved among them with such ease and obvious pleasure, like there were his people. They were his people, and he was theirs. Cows are people too, Jim would say. Yet this didn't mean that we never killed and ate some of those very same animals, a choice I struggled with at times, but came to agree with. Jim's insistence wasn't that humans should not eat animals at all. He thought vegetarianism was a good practical choice when the close relationship with the animals you ate wasn't possible. What Jim insisted on was relationship, shared story, and a radical sense of responsibility for the political implications of all of our choices. Jim made a living as a livestock rancher, but would not eat meat from an animal whose quality of life and impact on the land he couldn't account for. He called buying meat from a grocery store hiring a hitman. The German Jewish political philosopher Hannah Arendt said that no philosophy, no analysis, no aphorism, be it ever so profound, can compare an intensity and richness of meaning with a properly narrated story. I hope I did a proper job with that story I just told. As a young Jewish woman in 1930s Germany, Arendt was imprisoned at one time by the Gestapo for her research into anti-Semitic propaganda. She later survived Nazi Germany by fleeing to France and then to the United States. Arendt believed that totalitarianism, such as that we have rising down south now, becomes possible only when citizens retreat in large numbers from active engagement through public dialogue on the issues of the day. Arendt referred to Aristotle's concept of philia, friendship among citizens, as one of the fundamental requirements for the well-being of the city. And again, this concept of philia did not refer to our relationships with our most intimate circle of friends. It referred more to our network of middle relationships, with those neither what we call close friends nor foes within the social spheres we inhabit. For Arendt, like the Greeks, the essence of friendship consisted in discourse. Only the constant interchange of talk united citizens in a polis. This is what I'm calling here a sense of sharing in the telling of our societal story. As a young man, I found in Jim Corbett and those around him the union of values and action I'd been seeking. Community through shared work and common purpose. Now, later I should tell you that Jim turned out to be a little too ascetic and uncompromising with the world for my taste. Late in life, he lived almost entirely on a diet of fresh milk and oatmeal. He would come in from a long day of rain on range with cactus spines stuck in his toes. He wore sandals over severely arthritic feet. But he had trained himself to be so stoic that he ignored the pain. And it was best if you ignored pain, too. He refused my choice of blue as a suitable name for a solid red cow. Humor was not his strong suit. The bigger problem, though, where Jim and I eventually fell out, was that Jim did not wish me or anyone else to share much in the telling of our story. I came to have my own ideas about how the land should be managed and work should be done, and these ideas were less welcome than my labor. Eventually, my time in Cascabel ended the way so many once promising intergenerational stories do, with founder's syndrome. You've heard this one before. An older generation increasingly needs the help of the younger to get the work done, but still wants to make all the decisions about the whos, whys, and hows. Whether we're talking of farms and ranches or cities and nations, it's hard to believe we participate in a common story unless we also feel invited to play some role in the telling, in the dialogues and decisions that weave together a shared sense of meaning in the world. I'm worried about the polarization of our public dialogue today. I wonder how many of us still believe we participate in a common story. We live in a time when it's too easy to retreat into our private hobbies and preoccupations. It's too easy to log into our favorite entertainment content providers and echo chambers, letting many of our civic institutions, faith groups, social clubs, unions, and volunteer associations decline both in active membership and in power. It's too easy to stop turning to our neighbors and saying not just what we think, but why we think it, trying to find stories that connect even where we disagree. Now, you've probably been wondering for a while now when I'll finally get around to mentioning GVAT. After all, I speak to you today from my position as lead organizer for GVAT. I speak to you as members of one of our 26 member organizations. The thing is, without saying it exactly, I have been talking about what GVAT does this entire time. An inclusive, functioning democracy isn't something we can hire a proxy to make or maintain for us. We can't just vote and elect city councilors and MPs we like and call it a day. We can't hire a hitman to do the down and dirty work of building and sustaining relationships and reweaving a sense of hope and common purpose. Whether we're taking on the lack of affordable housing, access to mental health care, or the need to maintain a livable climate on the earth, our real work within GVAT is the work of inviting you to come forward as agents and authors of our democratic story, in which all of us are both listeners and tellers. This is our work. Let's go build real power. Power based not in domination, but in trust. Let's go use that collective power to make things better. Thank you.
Please rise as you're willing and able and join in singing our song, closing hymn, Wake Now My Senses. The words are in 298 and on the screen.